You're listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody, and welcome to We Are STS. I'm your host, Professor Joe Kane. This is episode 25. Chances are you've had something to do with mindfulness recently. Maybe you've been sent on mindfulness training, or perhaps you've been listening to a mindfulness podcast, or perhaps you're using a mindfulness app. In this episode, I hand the microphone over to Franziska Link, who worked in the STS newsroom in 2021. Franziska investigated the growing use of mindfulness therapies at universities, such as UCL, in their provision for student welfare and support. What good are these therapies? What do they involve? What are the pros and cons of this type of approach? Franziska interviews three people with quite different relationships to mindfulness programs. Here in STS, we want to give our students work experience in science communication. So each summer, we set up as many paid internships as we can, and we work with our students to create content for publications, like our annual magazine, STS Alchemy. We also ask our students to create a podcast episode on any subject they choose. We want something STS, but most of all, we want their ideas and their creativity. This episode fits those expectations perfectly. It's one rich with insights and rich with alternatives. Franziska runs the show today, which means I get to sit back and just listen. I'll see you on the other side.
So to get right into the topic and to make sure that we're all on the same page about what mindfulness actually is, I asked this very basic and fundamental question to Bodhilila Young, who is chair of the West London Buddhist Centre and has been teaching and practicing mindfulness for several decades now.
Mindfulness is basically trying to develop much more awareness, much more presence, much more engagement with our moment-by-moment experience, and through that awareness, having more choice and being able to, in a way, respond more creatively rather than out of reactions or out of our past conditioning or, you know, when our buttons are pressed, because often we react without being aware. I think everybody has got some experience of mindfulness, even though they wouldn't use that word. You know, any time that you're really interested in something, get really absorbed in it, you're probably practicing mindfulness. You know, those times when there's something that you really enjoy doing, maybe it's gardening, maybe it's cooking, maybe you're doing some kind of sport or yoga or something, and you're just like, or, you know, you're bringing together your concentration, you're not distracted, you're sort of absorbed in it. That's when you're practicing mindfulness. But also one of the ways that we cultivated it is through meditation. So sometimes people get a bit confused and they think the two are the same.
Could you expand on that more? So when you say there's mindfulness practices and then there's mindfulness meditation, how exactly does it work? Are they like dedicated courses? Do you need licenses to teach a course? And what kind of different interventions are there around mindfulness?
Well, in the UK at present, mindfulness isn't regulated. So in a way, anyone could set themselves up as a mindfulness teacher. But yes, I think what we're talking about, well, there's the courses and there's practices. So when I talk about practices, I would be talking maybe about the meditation practices or exercises or mindful movements and things like that that would be components in courses. And then you have various courses that have been developed as particular mindfulness interventions to help in particular situations or particular groups of people. So the, you know, the very earliest ones were the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which was designed to stop people relapsing into clinical depression. And that was very much coming from a medical model, and the people involved in that are supposed to have clinical training, and it's slightly different. And you've got the mindfulness-based stress reduction. So John Kabat-Zinn, he kind of pioneered mindfulness as a sort of medical intervention. And then you've got mindfulness-based interventions for things like dealing with addiction, breathworks, sort of pioneers in mindfulness-based pain management. And you will find people doing mindfulness for lots of different reasons, you know, in very specific things. So I think the thing is that some people have had much more exhaustive trainings than others. So if you are looking at a particular course, it might be worth looking at what the course is and who the trainers are and what training they've done. So when one does, a secular mindfulness course, you know, they're often like an 8-week course, and they will involve teaching people meditation practices, but also there'll be probably mindfulness in daily life. You'll have led meditation practice. You'll have some teaching input to give you some context about, you know, why we want to do mindfulness, the benefits of it, and maybe what the things we're working with, you know, quite often drawing on some of the neuroscience research and other research over the years. And also there'll be quite a lot of experiential sharing with other people on the course and learning from each other.
Although there are so many different applications and interventions, could you still kind of summarize what the research says about the benefits of mindfulness practices and meditation?
Well, there's a lot of research now showing how beneficial it is for lots of different things, whether that's health conditions, mental health, whether it's sort of how people manage in their lives and things like that, and particular applications. But I just think on a personal level, most people would benefit from some kind of mindfulness. And I think the fact that, yes, it may be a cheaper intervention, you know, when the government did their studies and they published their Mindful Nation, it's very much in there that they see it as being a very cost-effective health intervention or way of dealing with lots of things, prevention strategies and all that. But, it, you know, it doesn't mean to say that it doesn't, you know, is good. Whatever people's motives might be from doing it, I think people can benefit from doing mindfulness practice if you're doing it in a careful way. I mean, if we're doing a mindfulness course, we would always screen who comes on the courses. And, you know, there'd be a sort of like a questionnaire asking specific questions, and then you'd ring up the person, have a conversation about them.
That's super interesting that you mention it as an intervention that is cost effective and can basically help many people, if not everyone. Because I also see that UCL, for example, is promoting self-help resources through, I think it's the app Calm. Yeah, so like a few minutes of guided meditation, be it every day, every week, whatever. How would you kind of place mindfulness meditation and maybe specifically also these apps in the university context? Do you think they can be beneficial?
I think it's quite interesting when you look at mindfulness in education, mindfulness in schools, but where it's been most effective, I think, is when it's, you know, it's taken on by the whole institution, and where you've had maybe some of the staff having experiences and then getting trained, and then there's a sort of like cascade down, and then they might bring in outside people, but they've got staff people who can then continue doing the stuff with the students. I would have found it so beneficial when I was studying to have had mindfulness. And I know, you know, at university there's a lot of pressure. You know, there's the peer pressure, the social pressure, there's the pressure of all the assignments and all the exams and evaluations and things like that. But I think it's much easier to do these things in person, you know, and alongside other students than just doing something. I don't know. I think there's different kinds of learners, aren't there? So some people, it's fine having a book or just watching a video or just listening to something. But other people do need something more interactive or more kinesthetic. And I suppose ideally a course would involve that. We could have workshops or maybe, I mean, I think having the app, if it's a good app, and I haven't really looked at Calm in detail, but I'm sure it probably is if they've chosen that as one of their apps. But I would personally think it would make sense to be doing that alongside having some in-person stuff as well.
What Bodhilila said was really interesting to me, because the way she describes it, it seems like a really holistic idea and holistic concept to implement mindfulness in universities. And it's something that I personally haven't really witnessed yet. I don't know how it was pre-COVID, because most of my uni time was, characterized by COVID, unfortunately. But yeah, so I mostly see apps being promoted, and that's why I was lucky to talk to a researcher at UCL specifically about apps and their effect on students' well-being.
My name is Andrew Steptoe. I'm Professor of Psychology and Epidemiology at UCL, and I'm Head of the Department of Behavioral Science and Health at UCL.
One thing I really wanted to ask Andrew Steptoe was what the actual scientific background was of mindfulness and how it made its way from being part of a Buddhist meditation tradition to being so widely recognized and studied in science.
As you said, it has been linked and, you know, it certainly started as a kind of offshoot of Buddhist meditation, and meditation practices have been going on, particularly in the West, since about the 1960s. You know, you may have seen old film of the Beatles going off to their yogi and meditating. So there have been a lot of different sorts of meditation that have come and gone in popularity and have been in vogue and then gone out of vogue again. I think the current state of mindfulness is it is pretty well detached from the religious side, and many of the kind of main adherents of mindfulness and those people who value that don't necessarily see a religious side, though there may be a spiritual side, and I think that's a separate thing, you know, feeling about your sense of your place in the world, your self-worth, those sorts of things, which go beyond the sort of everyday, tend to come into the whole thing. But I think research such as the work that we did has helped to really provide an evidence base for the value of these methods for different groups of people. Our work was more focused on work stress and on the kind of chronic stresses that many people at work experience.
Now, your work focused mostly on the use of mindfulness apps in the workplace. Would you still say that your findings are applicable to students?
I don't see why not. I mean, I think university students, contrary to popular belief, do work quite hard, a lot of them, and many people get quite preoccupied and concerned about their work. When we think about work stress, what we think about is different components of that. One is the sheer sort of level of demand, you know, how much we have to do. And there are various points in a student's career where they feel they have to do an awful lot, so they do feel overloaded sometimes. Another component is to do with the amount of control that people feel they have over the work. You know, is it just a relentless slog? You know, there's constant deadlines that they have to fulfill, so they're not able to sort of really manage how they do their work. They're just rushing from one deadline to another. And that's a very common experience for many people in work stress, that they feel they have very little control over how they do the work. But I think another feature which comes in for some students anyway is a sort of sense of, in extreme form, kind of sense of perfectionism, you know, that people are concerned to do things very well. They may not get terribly good feedback about how very well they're doing it, you know, so they tend to be using internal standards and thinking, this is not good enough, I could really do better. And so that can turn into something of a sort of vicious circle of sort of constantly striving to do better. So these are all components of work stress, which are seen in the general work environment as well as among students.
Now, in terms of mental health services, stress is one thing, but has mindfulness meditation also been found to help with other problems such as depression and anxiety?
Yes, it's been used a lot, particularly in the area of depression, and some very good scientifically strong studies have been done in this area. But I think it's worth thinking about, you know, our well-being in a broader sense. I don't think the task ends when, you know, somebody says, no, I'm not feeling anxious, I'm not feeling depressed, because what you want is someone who's really feeling good. You know, they're feeling excited, they're feeling engaged with the world, you know, they're feeling positive about different aspects of their lives and their relationships. And so, you know, that's a task for everyone. It's not something that, is easily done.
Yeah, you say it's not easily done, but do you still think, since mindfulness apps seem to be quite a cost-effective and scalable solution, do you think they are a good fit for UCL's or any university's mental health and wellbeing strategy?
Well, I think it's a resource that people should be made aware of, and I think it's a resource that the university should encourage, because some people will find it very helpful. There will be more skeptical people who may not give it a try, but I think it's worth people giving it a go, particularly, you know, in the way in which students are having to operate now, where they're so isolated in a sort of, you know, face-to-face kind of way, and they are not experiencing the whole university in the way that we would hope and hope again in the future they'll be able to do. So, you know, I think there are good reasons for encouraging this and making it available as one of the tools that people could use to manage their well-being.
I am still very curious to know, because obviously, as you say, it's most likely going to have a beneficial effect for many, many people. But I've read more and more about kind of how it can have negative effects for some people as well. So I was wondering if you see any danger in kind of overhyping mindfulness as sort of the one-size-fits-all solution to mental health problems at university.
Well, I think there are a couple of answers to that. I mean, there's always a danger when you are using apps on your own that it may be, you know, rousing issues which, you know, that you weren't expecting. So that could cause problems. And, you know, certainly people who are psychologically vulnerable shouldn't be just doing this sort of thing completely on their own in an unsupervised way. So I think that might happen. But at the same time, as I said at the beginning, it doesn't work for everyone. And in our own studies, we found, for example, that the people who are benefiting most from the psychological point of view are the people who use it more, because we were able to see how many times they were visiting the app, how many times they're using the app. But the other side of that coin, obviously, is there is a certain proportion of people who decided it wasn't for them and they used it maybe once or twice and didn't use it anymore. So, you know, that's their choice and that's absolutely fine. But it does indicate that this is not going to be working for everyone. This is not a sort of panacea for all sorts of ills. And so, you know, thinking about the right fit for the individual, I think, is quite important.
I'm going to interrupt here. Let's take a short break.
What do I like about STS? For me, it's the opportunity to ask questions that seem off the table in other areas of science, like questions of regulation, politics, and power.
Let's get back to Franziska's story. She now turns to a more critical reflection about mindfulness therapies. Let's see where she takes us.
It's quite interesting because both Andrew and Bodhilila both acknowledged and said that it's a very good resource for many people and acknowledged the scientific research evidence for its good effects on students' mental health and well-being. But I'm still quite curious because both also mentioned that there can be negative effects and that it might not actually be good for everyone because, to be honest, to me, it always kind of seemed like it is very hyped and sometimes, yeah, it is promoted as the kind of solution that will help everyone. So, yeah, that's why I dug a bit deeper to find some critical voices on mindfulness meditation and the promotion of it at universities as well.
With the current trends of making all these things automatic and you being able to access them through all these apps, it's just become again like an aspirin.
You just heard Dr. Miguel Farias, who's an experimental psychologist specialized in the study of beliefs and spiritual practices, including mindfulness meditation. And I spoke to him mostly about his scientific criticism of, yeah, the hype around mindfulness that's going on right now.
I think the article that best summarizes some of the limitations and the problems with the hype with mindfulness is precisely called Mind the Hype, which was written by a consortium of mindfulness researchers. They summarize both the problems with how the term is conceptualized, the limitations of the literature, and also the media hype around it. I mean, there have been clearly extraordinary claims. It can work for things like recurrent depression, I mean, moderately well. There's less evidence for the things like weight loss, for example. I think the most, from a wider perspective, what is interesting is that this has been picked up by people who believe that this may bring about a transformation, not just of the individual at the deep level, but even of society, which is why they're pushing this to be used across all sectors, not just universities, but by the military and in schools. And in relation to that, I have more reservations.
What do you think are the reasons for that kind of lack of scientific rigor when it comes to mindfulness meditation practices?
How shall I frame it in a nice way? It's difficult. Well, they're just wrong models of the mind. Mm. So they treat the mind as either a muscle, something like it's like a muscle, you have to exercise it in this way, or something which is confusing, or it's in a confused state, and you need to sit down and use mindfulness for it to look at things as they are, to achieve some kind of pure awareness. I think here psychologists, including myself, are to be blamed, because we have in great part stopped thinking and teaching our students about models of the mind. How does the mind really work? So we teach them about very small things, but not really a grand picture of how the mind is supposed to work.
So since your name was one of the first really that popped up when I researched into the adverse effects of mindfulness practices, I was wondering if you could tell me more about the prevalence of adverse effects when it comes to mindfulness.
When we published the first edition of our book, The Buddha Pill, this was in 2015, we had a whole chapter on the potential adverse effects, and this was seen as very controversial at the time. And I had some colleagues trying to downplay this. Oh, it's very, very, very rare. And it only happens to people who have serious mental health issues already. And what we're seeing now is that it's none of the sort. It's not rare at all. So within the last couple of years, I mean, actually, just the last year. So we published a systematic review of the evidence from the 1970s until now. And we saw that there was a prevalence of around 8% of adverse effects in this literature of almost five decades, which is certainly not rare, but it's very similar to the rates of adverse events you find in psychotherapy in general. And given that these practices are being used as a form of psychotherapy, it's actually meaningful, that percentage. My colleagues in the States, Willoughby Britton and Jared Lindahl, they've also just published a couple of papers on this. They found that people who had the first contact with mindfulness through an app, they had a greater likelihood of having an adverse event which would be impairing, which means it would have an effect on a negative effect on their daily functioning. I think it's the first bit of data we have on the negative effects associated with using mindfulness apps.
That's super interesting that you say that, actually, because I do see quite a big trend nowadays and mindfulness apps are booming, like the industry is booming, and universities are turning more and more towards this kind of self-help strategy. So what is your general take on that strategy?
I think that's a really sad state of affairs, actually, in the sense that when psychotherapy was developed in the early 20th century, it came about because it clearly was needed for various reasons. And there was a lot of goodness in it, as not just as something to deal with mental health problems, which I mean, it also did, but as an instance of personal discovery, almost like soul searching and soul making. And with the current trends of making all these things automatic and you being able to access them through all these apps or whatever, it's just become again like an aspirin. It's just it doesn't really deal with what is happening. And I think it's just a very, very sad state of affairs. And universities, as you rightly said, are now just throwing out these well-being kits. I mean, particularly in a university in which you're supposed to be shaping, I mean, the minds of intelligent people in a more interesting way, I think it's actually rather counterproductive.
In light of all that, what kind of suggestions would you make to universities in terms of changing their mental health strategy?
There should be much easier access to properly trained therapists and for them to be more generous in access to these to these people. I mean, I think, particularly in the UK, the amount of money that students have to pay for their education really, really calls for some generosity from the universities on access to proper mental health services, and not just these ridiculous web-based or smartphone applications.
Having heard so many different perspectives already on mindfulness, of from a teacher's perspective, from academics perspectives. I was really curious how actual students perceive this. And so I'm really happy to be talking to a now PhD student who has been at UCL since their bachelor's and who's now looking at mindfulness in their own research.
My name is Davy. I am a second year part-time PhD student in the SDS department. I am studying in the philosophy of medicine and sort of disability studies area. And I'm looking at how patients with contested illnesses, so illnesses not 100% understood by medicine, like fibromyalgia, like ME, how those patients interact with those doctors in medical spaces, and how sort of injustices, specifically epistemic injustice, occurs. And epistemic injustice is just to do with knowledge. Who is deemed to be a knower in what space? So in the doctor's appointment, the doctor's opinion is usually the one that matters, and patients' maybe valid contribution about what's happening in their illness experience is often ignored or dismissed. So that's the interaction that I'm looking at.
So Davy, in your case specifically, could you tell the listeners kind of why you're doing the research that you're doing and also how you personally came across mindfulness, mindfulness practices? What's your history with it?
Sure, yeah. So the reason I'm so interested in looking at the illness fibromyalgia is that I have it. So I've had chronic pain for a really long time. And over the course of like the last decade, I've tried all sorts of different treatments and been referred to all different types of things. But mindfulness was something that was suggested to me while I was going to a pain clinic where they offer, you know, they do medicine, they do physio, they do a little bit of mental health help. And I did really give it a go because I'd heard a lot of people raving about what mindfulness could do for them. But I found that the focus that specifically, I think specifically the Headspace app, it's the only one I've tried, but the focus on sort of picturing the whole body from the ground up and really focusing in on the signals and the breath. And that for me, as a person who's nerves are constantly sending pain signals to their brain, that was not maybe the best thing that I could have done for my pain, because all it did was make me far more conscious and aware of the pain that I'm usually trying to sort of ignore and push to the side so I can get on with my day. But also, yeah, mindfulness apps, these kind of things, I think do not address A, how severe the illness experience is for fibromyalgia patients, but also it can feel kind of like being fobbed off, perhaps. I think there are ways in which mindfulness can be helpful for these patients, but I really do think it has to be supplementary to the, you know, physical therapy, pharmaceutical interventions, actual like mental health provision, which at the moment is just not available. So mindfulness often feels like, yeah, just simply not sufficient to treat the issue. I think it's used as a bit of a band-aid.
I mean, although these apps were recommended to you in a like outside of the university, how do you generally view the current UCLs and also universities, mental health services and general health services? And do you think mindfulness meditation practices, mindfulness apps should have a place in that as well?
I mean, particularly over the last year, with the amount of stressors happening, I think student psychological support is a neglected sort of area. And yeah, like I say, this isn't really specific to UCL. You can generalise to most universities seem to have inadequate support for what their students actually need. So yeah, so in the current climate where there are long waiting lists to access student support, and there are, you know, maybe only X amount of counsellors to work with however many students that need them, I feel like mindfulness, again, is kind of like putting a band-aid over a big wound, because it's a very good supplementary tool, I think, for training or being more conscious of your thoughts and patterns and things like that. But it is not going to address, say, something like severe depression. I do feel as well it's a little bit of maybe a cost-cutting measure to try and, you know, try and get people to use mindfulness apps and to take their mental health into their own hands, which I also think assumes that someone suffering from a bad patch of mental health, that's kind of assuming they can maybe do more than they can while they're in the middle of this. You know, sometimes you need an outside intervention. It seems a little useless to say to someone who's struggling with severe depression, you need to do this mindfulness thing for 15 minutes every day. Because I know from personal experience that that kind of advice in the moment can feel like an impossibility. Like, you know, if I can't get out of bed, how am I supposed to manage my own health in this way? Yeah, I think it is sort of passing the buck on responsibility, trying to cut costs. I don't think it's necessarily a malicious thing, but it is a systemic issue that needs sorting in this country, you know, more generally as well.
What do you think, as a kind of closing question now, what should UCL and what should universities in the UK do to provide students with the mental and general health support that they need?
First of all, I think, yeah, it would have to be a very well-funded department. And I think it would just need a proportional amount of counsellors and psychologists available for the number of students that are there. I would also remove things like student support services needing doctors' letters to say, yes, this person has depression, anxiety, something like that. I don't think requiring that extra step of sort of authentication actually helps anyone, because I don't really understand why anyone would lie to access counselling. And you know, just adding that extra level of difficulty in for someone who's already struggling with mental health. And the fact that there are so many international students at UCL requiring them to get doctor's notes and things like that, I just feel like it's another thing that's almost designed to sort of maybe turn you away from accessing the service in the first place. I also think like the personal tutor system that we already have could be sort of revamped a little to include a mental health check-in with students. I don't think there's any harm in that. You know, it doesn't have to be deep, just how are your studies going and how are you personally and can we help in any way? Keep a closer eye. I mean, I don't think everyone needs to be monitored, but I do think that there are too many gaps in the system at the moment that people slip through. Yeah, I just think as like a takeaway on mindfulness in general, I would say that it is completely valid if you find mindfulness helpful, because, you know, research does support that for certain things, it really is helpful. But also, I would say, if you go to the GP with a serious concern and they, or you know, the student mental health services with a serious concern, and you don't feel like you were taken seriously because you were, you know, given an app or something, I would advise people, you can always give it a try, but also don't be afraid to go back and ask for the actual help that you think you need, be that medication, be that seeing a therapist. Don't be afraid to advocate for yourself, because the system won't advocate for you, unfortunately.
I just love the pace and the structure of this episode. Thanks, Franziska. This was brilliant. And this episode shows just how useful and current philosophy of science can be. Oh, that's what I love about STS. New ideas in every story. Always room for reflection and analysis. If you know someone who might like to study with us, just ask them to get in touch. Maybe it's to explore stories like this one. Or maybe they're interested in philosophy of science and medicine generally. Or maybe, just maybe, they're interested in history of science, like I am. These all fit under the umbrella of Science and Technology Studies, or STS. Music today included two pieces, Roland at 5 and Ecossaise in E-flat, both by Kevin MacLeod, and both available online at the website filmmusic.io. In the break, you also heard Dan Sharp, one of last year's students in the STS newsroom. We Are STS is a production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. If you want to find out more about the show, listen to past episodes, or give us some feedback, just visit us online. Here's the address. It's ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast. Well, that's all for today. Thanks for coming along. We'll have another episode ready soon. Until then, just remember, there's knowledge to be found just about everywhere, and that together, we are STS. Bye now. You've been listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Subscribe to the show and join us online. The address, ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast.